Let's hit it. That failed to fire. All right. Let's hit it.
Commanding you to bow down.
I'm on your side.
By branding you as a rebel.
But you're not.
A traitor.
This isn't freedom. This is fear.
We are not the government. The government is not us.
This is...
What is it? Yeah. This is Dino Files. Happening again. It's almost as if I have this weekly thing down. I'm not doing it on a consistent day of the week, but at least it's happening weekly. It's not at a consistent time either. But at least it's happening weekly. Or as close to it as I can possibly get. I'm going to copy this link real quick and send this out. All right. Man, how is everybody doing out there? I'm having a good goddamn time. I've been looking at upsetting things for the last little bit, so I'm looking forward to having a fun show. I'm looking forward to having a really fun show. I think this will be well worth my time. This is episode 40. And I have prepared something for you all today that I think you'll quite enjoy. However, as per usual, the first thing we have to get to is some interesting legislation. I don't have any today. I don't actually have any interesting legislation for you today, so we're not going to do that. And that has been the interesting legislation segment. Moving on. You guys know I like to talk about interesting articles that I've seen online that I consider to be interesting. Well, I want to talk about one of those today. As per usual, this one comes from Quillet. Quillet, I think, is a very, I think it's underserved. I think it's not underserved. I think it's not, it doesn't really get all of the, I think it doesn't get the credit it deserves for being a really, really good outlet. Hi, Maxo. Just drop in the chat real quick if you've been having trouble with the client, because I might need to actually change the client, because I've seen some people have issues with it. Quillet article. Interesting one. That's where I was. May 21st, 2018. This was published on Quillet by Velvet Favretto. Well, that sounds like a nom de plume if I've ever heard one. And I have heard one. Postmodernism and the Decline of the Liberal Arts. Now, usually I just read the first chunk, but I actually want to read, a little bit of the first chunk, and then I want to go deeper into the piece and read a section that I thought was really interesting. It's not all that deep in the piece, but the liberal arts were so named for their orientation toward free thought and the foundational claim that they existed to enrich the lives of free people. They are, in other words, dependent on the open-mindedness of individuals wishing to develop their knowledge and understanding by exploring thousands of years of history and literature produced by human civilization. Despite this, universities in recent years have seen a rapid decline in the reputation and value of liberal arts degrees, whereas once an education in literature and philosophy was highly revered in academia, setting the world at its students' feet. Today, a liberal arts education is widely regarded as a useless endeavor for aimless students, which offers no clear path for the future. Now, this is, going away from the piece for a second, this is something that everyone knows. Everyone likes to make fun of the guy who gets the philosophy degree, right? Despite the fact that that dude is fascinating to talk to, nobody wants to employ him. That's why these people work in academia. People with philosophy degrees are supposedly supposed to work in academia. That's sort of the path that you lay out for yourself when you go for one of these style of degrees. But it's apparently, according to this article, it's not even all that valuable in academia anymore. And I'm going to go a little bit deeper And I'm going to read a little bit from slightly deeper in the story. Postmodernism, in both the artistic world and the real worlds, is concerned with interpretation and subjectivity, and the deconstruction of overarching, quote, meta-narratives. Its opposition to these meta-narratives, according to the philosopher Stephen Hicks, can lead to a wholesale rejection of the Enlightenment's salient ideas of reason, logic, knowledge, and truth. One of postmodernism's most famous thinkers, Stanley Fish, has said of deconstruction, a postmodernist technique, that it relieves me to the obligation to be right and demands only that I be interesting. That's in that quote. This is the essence of postmodern theory. You don't have to be right because right and wrong don't exist. That's very true. If you've ever talked to a postmodernist thinker, a postmodernist, it's just hard. It's frustrating to try and talk to one of these people because they have no interest in knowledge when you're trying to talk to a postmodernist because they don't feel that it's possible to be wrong. Except for you. You're wrong. Which is one of the greatest things about postmodernists when I like to try and argue with them is that nobody can be wrong as long as they're agreeing with the postmodernist. If you're not agreeing with the postmodernist, well, then you're wrong. It's fascinating. Not really realistic. Everybody wants to make fun of the guy who has the degree in philosophy because his head's in the clouds and other shit like that. But the denial of reality, you can't really get much cloudier than that, as far as I'm concerned. But you know, whatever. So the pursuit of knowledge, which is what the liberal arts are supposedly about, right? The pursuit of knowledge in a context of free thought is not valuable to the postmodernists. They don't think it's worth their time. This is one of the major problems as an anarchist, especially talking to people. Everyone has been infected with this postmodern idea, most of which come from Rousseau, that like we don't need hierarchies, that hierarchies are inherently bullshit. Which is dumb. the denial of hierarchy is a denial of a massive swath of not only human nature, but also all of the animal kingdom. So it's, you know, it's strange, but that's one of the more damaging things that's come out of Rousseau in particular, but it's a kind of a fractal of postmodernism, is these postmodernists don't believe in reality. This is part of the reason that, again, I talk about this periodically, the Trump derangement syndrome, my cat's making noise, is such a big deal, is because the Trump derangement syndrome I have defined as a denial of objectivity from a position of a feeling about Trump. So it's either being very pro-Trump or very anti-Trump, and it leads you to deny objective truth based entirely upon the fact that you really like or really hate Trump. That's how I've defined Trump derangement syndrome, in order to make it cut both ways, because I think it has to, right? Like, if you have people who really hate something, then the people who really love that thing must also be, there must be something going on there, too. Doesn't have to be that either side is necessarily wrong, but in this case, in the case of Trump's derangement syndrome, it just happens to be that both sides, the very, very pro-Trump and the very anti-Trump, are both wrong about a lot. Because they deny what is objectively true, because they're afflicted with TDS. Moving on. I always like to read something from The Fire. TheFire.org, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education. This I thought was interesting. Published on May the 21st. Brigham University campus police surveil students and threaten prosecution over anti-racism flyers. Brigham, New York, May 21st, 2018. After calling students' expressive activities, quote, a violation of the law and of the student handbook, end quote, State University of New York at Binghamton campus, police surveilled students' literature distribution, threatened to prosecute them for posting flyers indoors, and told them they would be held responsible if other students littered their flyers. Today, FIRE calls on Binghamton University to drop its investigation and commit to ensuring its campus police respect students' First Amendment rights. By, quote, by surveilling students' expressive activity and warning them that they should be held account, that they would be held accountable for their peers' behavior, campus police implied that students were engaging in prohibited conduct and could face punishment for doing so, said FIRE, end quote, said FIRE senior program officer Sarah McLaughlin, who writes some really good pieces too. Quote, unless the university reverses course, Binghamton University risks chilling the speech of not just the students distributing flyers, but the entire student body. On March 28th, a group of students posted approximately 200 flyers in Binghamton University's downtown center. The flyers criticized the university's response to recent incidents of perceived racist expression on campus. After about an hour, a campus police officer stopped student Dominic Davey and questioned him about the flyers, warning him that he had broken state law. Binghamton University investigator Patrick Riley reaffirmed the officer's comments to the student newspaper, The Pipe Dream, claiming that the flyers constituted, quote, a violation of the law and of the student handbook, end quote, and that an investigation was ongoing. After being warned that they would not continue posting flyers indoors, the students began distributing flyers directly outside of the downtown center. Shortly after, the same campus police officer stopped the students, explaining that people came to him and were offended by their flyers. That the quote there was, quote, people came to him and were offended by, end quote, their flyers. He went on to say that although he, quote, respects, end quote, their point of view, when, quote, it alarms other people, then he has to interject and he has to do something about it, end quote. The officer also warned the students that they would be asked to stop distributing flyers if their recipients littered them. The officer informed them, if you're handing them out and people go in the downtown center and start throwing them on the ground, end quote, he would tell them to stop because, quote, because it's going to come back to you, end quote. One student asked the officer why they would be held accountable for other people littering. The officer replied, quote, it's because it's being generated by you guys. They would not be doing that if you guys didn't generate the papers, end quote. Well, in that case, every cigarette maker in the country needs to be sued for all the butts in the fucking street. The students were interrupted by campus police twice that day while distributing flyers outdoors and once the next day. Fire wrote to Binghamton University President Harvey G. Stinger on April 18th, asking the university to end its investigation immediately and ensure that campus police officers receive proper training on students' right to distribute expressive materials on campus. Binghamton University failed to respond to Fire's letter. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to defending liberty, freedom of speech, due process, and academic freedom, legal equality, and freedom of conscience on America's college campuses. That's the whole piece. I usually don't read the whole piece, actually, from Fire, but I did that one because this shit happens a lot. It happens all the time. People just approach people and say, hey, you're not allowed to do that, and they're wrong. Plainly wrong. And yet, these things happen. I want to read a story from the Fifth Column, not the whole story. I'm just going to read sort of the introduction to it. This is from the fifthcolumnnews.com. And the V is in there, if you want to go read from that website. I like them quite a bit. I've interacted with the guy who runs it. He's fascinating. Really cool guy. May 21st. Saudi authorities, since May 15th, 2018, detained a total of 7 prominent women's rights defenders. Human Rights Watch said today. Oh, I'm sorry, I never read the headline. Saudi Arabia, women's rights advocates arrested. Okay, continuing. The advocates have long advocated ending the ban on women driving and abolishing the discriminatory male guardianship system. Among those arrested are Iman Al... I'm not even going to try. There's 2 names there. Along with 2 male activists, but authorities have not revealed the reason behind the arrests. Saudi rights defenders said that in September 2017, the royal court had called the country's prominent activists, including some of those just detained, and warned them not to speak to the media. The calls were made the day the authorities announced that they would lift the driving ban on women in June. Saudi authorities should release the activists immediately or charge them with a recognizable criminal offense. That's the beginning of that story. There's I only read about half of it, but it's very interesting. This is the kind of thing that people want to talk about. People want to talk about women's rights. And that's fine. That's a good conversation to have. I don't begrudge anybody having a conversation about a thing that they're concerned about. I do have a problem with people not accepting facts as facts. But, you know, that's neither here nor there. The real issue, the real worldwide, globally, the real place that humans, that women's rights especially are trampled upon the most is in this area of the world. It happens in other places too. There are sexist cultures everywhere, but it's enshrined in law here and in other places that are based on theocratic systems of government, like Saudi Arabia. It is enshrined in law that women do not have the same rights as men. That's fucked up, right? Am I the only one? Because we're not allowed to talk about it, because it automatically makes you Islamophobic. Well, yeah, I mean, this is an Islamic theocracy, and they're fucked up. I'm not scared of it. It's not a phobia. It's true. So, there's that. Oh, goodness gracious. Goodness gracious me. Moving on. I had a conversation. This isn't our main topic. I had a conversation today with my grandma. She's really cool, really smart. But she was talking about where she grew up. And kind of the... She grew up in... Not grew up in. She lived in various places. But she lived in this, like, a small rural town. Very southern. Very... It was in... Technically, it was in Oklahoma. But, you know, still the South, I think. And she was describing things that happened in this town. And there are things that I think if I were to talk to people who are not from any rural area or have no familiarity with rural areas, haven't been there ever or lived there or had family who lived there, things like that, I would think that they would say that didn't happen. That's not true. They would be the person who's like, I'll take things that never happened for 100, right? But, or 200, there are no 100s in Jeopardy. But they did. They did. And I'm not going to say exactly what. There was a lot. We talked for quite a long time. There were a lot of stories told. But I think there's a lack of understanding, especially on the coasts, of what exactly rural America is. Especially old school rural America. And especially the rural South. But we're not going to get into that specifically. I saw this covered on the fifth column, and I thought it was interesting. And I want to read just a little bit of it, because... It's interesting, I think, and I, it's one of the reasons that journalists are so reviled, especially by conservatives, is because there's a cross section where conservatism, there's a nexus sort of conservatism being rural and seeing that the news has no fucking clue what your life is like. There's an interesting nexus that happens there, and so I just wanted to read just a little bit of this. May 19th. From the fifth column, covering rural America, what reporters get wrong and how to get it right. Sarah Sampson reports on socioeconomic class politics and more for national and international outlets, including The Guardian, New Yorker, and The Cut. And that's just a little, it begins with a description of who she is. I just want to read that first sentence. What reporters get wrong, they oversimplify and mischaracterize the political, social, and cultural nature of rural areas. Quote, often the monolithic portrayal of rural America amounts to a whitewashing along racial lines. In fact, rural areas are much more racially diverse than one would think from reading national headlines. Those parts of the country have always been more than white people, and as we speak, they are diversifying, in some places quite rapidly, often due to an influx in immigrant populations taking jobs in industries like industrial agriculture and meatpacking plants. This is very true in one specific place that some of my family's from. Barely a majority of the eligible voting population ends up at the polls, and then somewhere around under half of the people vote for the candidate who wins that state, and then the whole square is colored red on a cable news graphic. The underlying poison of this whole discussion is that it renders enormous swaths of this country invisible. People of color in rural areas, moderate or left-leaning people in rural areas, and for that matter, conservative people in urban areas, of which there are many. One of them is now the president of our country. How to get it right? Editors should try, if possible, to commission stories from local reporters who know their communities. This is one of the things that I saw very recently on an ABC News post. ABC posted a thing about a vape in Florida exploding, blowing a dude's freaking face away. That happens sometimes. Usually it's because somebody's using an unregulated mod, box mod, that they've somehow fucked up. They've either caused there to be a short to the battery or to the coil, or they have a battery that has a bad wrap and then it shorts out on the side of the box or what have you. It doesn't matter. This is a dangerous thing that sometimes happens, right? And it's typically due to user error. And the picture that they put, and they never specified what kind of box mod it was, and the picture that they put of was one of those little gas station e-cigs. One of the little thin little gas station e-cigs, not like the blue style ones, but the ones you see now, the ones that are closer to like what vapors were actually using a few years ago. And so people, everybody's on there talking about how dangerous, blah, 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 all this other stuff. Well, the local affiliate for ABC in that Florida area, the local affiliate mentioned that it was an unregulated box mod. They said the company, the local affiliate, did better reporting than national outlet. But nobody fucking follows that local affiliate on Twitter. Everybody follows fucking ABC, right? So this is part of the problem. That annoyed me to no end. It's your local affiliate. Your local affiliate got it right. That's your affiliate. Just pull the story from them. You can do that. You're the same company. Fuck me. It bothered the hell out of me. I'm just going to read some more of this list about what they get wrong and how they can fix it. What reporters get wrong. They come to a story with preconceived notions about class and place. How to get it right? Don't just look at for the sources your editor wants. That's one of those things that you see, too. The people who get the people who go viral on the news, that's the kind of people they want. People who go viral on YouTube or whatever, like the, any of those viral man-on-the-street interviews. What reporters get wrong? They edit direct quotations in a way that plays to their personal biases. How to get it right? Consider the mission. Consider the mission meaning to tell the truth. What reporters get wrong? They focus solely on politics and the political divide. How to get it right? Dig for news stories by actually getting to know the people you're covering and tapping into the community resources. That's one of the things, too. Everybody, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and a lot of podcasts are produced in LA. There are a lot of them are produced in New York, Las Vegas, you know, places that have a bi-coastal feel to them. And they don't really understand that rural America, especially the rural South, is more than just lynching black people. Like, that seems to be their conception of what rural America actually is. Is like posses getting together and lynching black people. And that's not anything like what the world actually is. But they're not really concerned with that. They're concerned with... I think it's twofold. I think part of it is that they're concerned with serving their own bias, and they're also concerned, though, with the fact that a lot of these journalists are bi-coastal type people. They don't know what they should be looking for because their conception of rural America is just a bunch of white dudes in a trunk going to lynch a black guy. Like, that's their whole conception of what rural America is as a journalist. So bringing that bias, I mean, it's almost like you can forgive them for it if it wasn't so obviously ignorant, and a journalist is supposed to be somebody who can look at a thing rather objectively, right? Of course, the answer is no, because that's not the case. I don't believe it ever has been, but that's what journalism is. It just really bothers me. I'm sorry. It just really, really bothers me that the way that, you know, I'm from Texas. I know a lot of people from the Midwest. I know a lot of people who are from the South. I know a lot of people from more rural areas than I'm from. I'm not from a particularly rural area, but I'm secondarily related to a lot of them. I had a lot of family in small towns all over, right? So there's just a lot of misunderstanding about what exactly rural America, especially the rural South, is and what it's like to live there. It's one of the reasons that White Lash got such a big... I want to talk about this for just a second. There was this concept after Trump won, and it's pretty much pervasive now, that White Lash was the thing that made Trump get elected. That this was basically payback to black people for Obama, which is, if you look at the statistics for half a second, you can see that's not the case, right? But that's kind of one of the prevailing narratives about why Donald Trump is president, is because of White Lash. But what people don't understand, especially about rural America, is that rural America is fucking dying. And a lot of those white rural voters who voted for Donald Trump voted for him because he promised to give him a fucking job. That's one of the things that you have to understand about this, is that there's not some sort of weird, I don't even know how to describe it, what their conception of the Midwest, of rural America must be. These aren't privileged people. A lot of these people are poor. Very poor. Now, some of them aren't. Some of them are farmers with big plots of land, and they've actually got some scratch, but not all of them, and not a lot of them, especially the smaller farmers. They don't got shit. And so the journalists as a whole, these bi-coastal journalists, they just don't see rural America for what it actually is. And that's how a narrative like White Lash is allowed to exist. Because you don't have to look at the statistics. You just know, oh, well, a lot of rural voters voted for Trump. They must be fucking racist whites. Like, that's what it's got to be, right? Because that's how they conceive of rural America. The racism is a foregone conclusion. You don't have to actually look at the statistics because that's just common knowledge. But if you actually look at the statistics, you can see that black people didn't really vote for Hillary Clinton. If you look at the minority numbers, Hillary Clinton did, in a lot of places, double digits worth of worse than Barack Obama did with people of color. If you look at the statistics, there's just not... I don't know. It just really bothers me. It just really bothers me that nobody is interested in understanding 90% of the fucking country as far as landmass is concerned. Anyway. So, we're going to move on. We are going to move on to our main topic. And this was introduced to me, I was listening to the No Agenda Show today, actually. And they had this woman on, this woman, not on the show, they played a clip from her. She was on a PBS show called The Open Mind, and she is Catherine Ebon, the Open Mind has a little short thing. Investigative reporter Catherine Ebon joins us on The Open Mind to shed light on her findings surrounding pharmaceutical counterfeiting. Ebon uncovered the comprehensive structure of how underpoliced generic companies operate for Fortune magazine. As she writes, quote, "It's not a tale of cutting corners or lax manufacturing practices, but one of outright fraud in which the company knowingly sells substandard drugs around the world, including the U.S., while working to deceive regulators." Now, that's interesting and fascinating, but that's not the main topic. That's not my main concern. It is interesting that the FDA can't do their job or won't do their job. It is interesting that this whole framework, especially as an anarchist, when people say, well, you want the FDA selling people poison? They already are. The FDA doesn't check overseas generics in a way that makes any sense. And you can come find this video. If you can go find this video, it's on the Open Mind's YouTube channel. Catherine Ebon, I'm sure if you just Googled Open Mind Catherine Ebon, it would be right there. That's Catherine with a K. But I want to play just a little bit, and this might let you know sort of what my primary concern actually is with this.
There's really a bigger issue, which I see as one of basic economics. I've been investigating the pharmaceutical industry for well over a decade now. And almost every single fraud and con that I have looked at is originating from the fact that we have the most expensive drugs in the world. That is really at the root of everything that we see, whether it's trying to expand market share and expand patient base and sell as many drugs as you can, or whether it's the fact that because we have the most expensive drugs and nobody can afford them anymore, we are forced into the arms of these absolutely low-cost, bottom-of-the-barrel generic drug makers, most of whom are located overseas in India and China.
So her primary focus is that a lot of these generic drugs are produced in places where the regulatory reach of the U.S. isn't, right? And, of course, the very simple solution is that, well, you just test the batches, right? You just test a chunk of a batch as it comes into the United States. But, of course, the obvious solutions are never the ones that are used, and I think there's actually a little bit of a quid pro quo going on with the FDA as far as that's concerned. Because the FDA, when they go in, she mentions it in this piece, I'll just cover it real quick. With the FDA, when they go to check out the manufacturers, they give them advance notice. And that's like, I mean, if you're going to go as a regulatory controller and you're going to go someplace and you're going to check to make sure that they're complying with the regulations and you tell them 2 weeks before you're going to be there that you're going to be there, well, you're not going to find anything wrong when you get there, are you? That's fairly obvious. So I suspect that there might be a little bit of quid pro quo going on there, but that's not my main concern. My main concern is the bit that she mentioned about how expensive they are. And about marketing, expanding the customer base, selling as many drugs as you can. We all know this is the mission of pharmaceutical companies. They exist to make money, as every other company does. And if you're a pharmaceutical company, the best way to make money is to jack up prices and to sell to everyone you can. And they have a vested interest in making sure that everybody's taking pills, right? Now, I want to be very clear about one very specific thing. Or I want to be clear about two things, actually. But one of them is more of a PSA. The first thing I want to be clear about is that you have to understand that I'm not anti-medication. I'm not anti-really any kind of medication. I myself take medication that a lot of people are very much against. And it's because I came to the decision that it was necessary for me, in conjunction with, of course, get government to falsely vouch for your safety. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, look, that's... I'm not against medication. What I'm against is over and unnecessary medication, right? She's primarily concerned with the safety, but I'm more concerned with the marketing angle. And so I want to play another chunk of this. This is the last one, I swear. And then I'll start talking about the actual topic. This is from farther, much, much deeper in the interview. That was from almost the very beginning. This is from much deeper in the interview.
In big pharma, where you really see the fraud is in marketing. It's in sales. Right. So we made this huge investment. We did all this research. And now we're going to try to expand all the indicators for this drug. Hey, you know, opioids? Let's market them to children. Let's market them to old folks. Let's market them to everybody. Let's, you know, I mean, the big thing that Purdue Pharma did, and, you know, I've written about right. Purdue Pharma, is they tried to basically expand who they marketed their drug to.
Normalize it.
To normalize it, exactly. They tried to normalize it to say, you know what, because our drug, they like to claim that it was non-addictive.
Right.
And therefore it could be safely marketed by ordinary doctors to sort of ordinary pain patients. That it was no longer going to be just reserved for a dying cancer patient. It was going to be marketed to, you know, anybody with a backache.
Right.
That's what happened there.
Now, the story that she's referring to about Purdue Pharma, not a lot of people might know about. FDA approved, it's cool. Exactly. Exactly. The story about Purdue Pharma that not a lot of people are aware of, it kind of fits perfectly in with
everything
this.
Is sneaky up around Sneakyville.
Thanks, Charlie. Charlie said it perfectly. The issue with Purdue Pharma was that they basically lied about the way that hydrocodone and oxycodone worked. And they came out and they started trying to prescribe it to everybody. And the way they did that, I have the Wikipedia pulled up here. Again, it's Wikipedia, so be aware of that. Under a marketing strategy that Arthur Sackler had pioneered decades earlier, the company aggressively pressed doctors to prescribe the drug, wooing them with free trips to pain management seminars and pain speaking engagements. Sales soared. The drug was marketed as smooth and sustained pain control all day and all night. When taken on a 12-hour schedule, as having lower abuse potential than immediate-release oxycodone because of its time-release properties, even though there was no scientific evidence backing that conclusion. However, at the start of 2000, widespread reports of OxyContin abuse surfaced. The results obtained from a proactive abuse surveillance program called Research Abuse Diversion Addiction-Related Surveillance, RADARS. Wow, that's naming a thing in order to get the acronym. Holy shit. That's really bad. Sponsored by Purdue Pharma LP, pronounced OxyContin and hydrocodone the most commonly abused pain medications. In 2012, New England Journal of Medicine published a study that found that 76% of those, quote, 76% of those seeking help for heroin addiction began by abusing pharmaceutical narcotics, primarily OxyContin, and draws a direct line between Purdue's marketing of OxyContin and the subsequent heroin epidemic in the U.S. And this still happens today. There's a lot of stories of heroin abuse that actually start at the dentist office. People who come out of a dental, operation with a prescription for hydrocodone or OxyContin, and they start taking that, and then they get addicted to it, and then they move on to, the street drugs. Once you can't get your prescription filled anymore, what are you gonna do to get your opiate fix? Well, you're gonna use opiates, but not all opiates are created equal, right? Some are heroin, some are fentanyl, some are OxyContin, oxycodone, and some are, hydrocodone, right? So you have a broad swath of this kind of thing. You have a what was clearly an unverified claim, a series of unverified claims from a pharmaceutical company used to promote a drug, right? And that the doctors were effectively bribed to do so, right? I'm not going to say they were outright bribery because then I would be making an accusation of a crime, right? But, I mean, they got a trip out of the deal. So that's kind of how this happens. And if you think that the Purdue situation is the only one, you're crazy. Now, there's two issues. Maxo in the chat says, if government didn't protect us all, I bet we'd do more quality research the first time. Yeah, you'd think, right? If all of the regulatory power is supposed to fall on the FDA, well, and the FDA drops the fucking ball, well, what are you going to do then? Your monopolized regulatory agency didn't do a good job. If you had competing regulatory agencies, maybe this would have been caught. But I digress. The issue with the cost is one that I've talked about in a lot of places, and it's not my primary concern. The issue with the cost, I just want to dig into just for a second. The issue with the cost is because of insurance. I mean, that's what it is. It's the same issue that causes rising costs higher education. Higher education gets more expensive because the government gives a loan to everybody and their dog. The money's there, so they jack up the prices because they can get the money, right? That's just making money. That's what that is. If there's a massive pool of money there, you're going to tap it. And that's all the pharmaceutical companies do. All they do is they jack up the price so that, yeah, the end consumer pays a little more, but not as much as the fucking insurance company's paying. That's why insurance gets more expensive. And that's why none of these problems are fixed when the government takes over insurance. Because insurance is the problem. And frankly, when you have a government running insurance, I imagine you're going to have higher insurance payouts. Healthcare is going to be even more expensive because government sucks at everything. Insurance companies actually have some power to haggle a little bit. Insurance companies haggle with doctors. Insurance companies haggle with hospitals. They haggle with pharmaceutical companies. They get the price down so that they have to pay less. They're still paying more than they would maybe at market price. But the expansion of insurance is what has caused the rise in costs of healthcare across the board. I just want to make that very clear. But let's move on to my real concern. And this is the thing that, this is the kind of thing that you have to be careful when researching. Because there are a lot of unscrupulous organizations out there that have this same gripe. And they have this same gripe from a different place, right? One of the primary ones is the, let me Google it real quick. It's going to be quiet for just a second. Sorry, I know it's shitty radio. Okay, we got this Google search going. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights. Okay, the Citizens Commission on Human Rights is an organization I'll just read from the Wikipedia. The Citizens Commission on Human Rights, CCHR, is a nonprofit organization established in 1969, headquartered in Los Angeles, California. Stated mission is to eradicate abuses committed under the guise of mental health and enact patient and consumer protections. So this is an organization that purports to battle against, you know, over-medication, all this other stuff, like give kids medications that they don't need. This organization is owned and operated by the Church of Scientology, right? And they've got things like that everywhere. The Church of Scientology specifically has Narcanon, right? Do not send your people to a Narcanon rehab facility. It's a Scientology indoctrination center, right? So you have to be very careful when you're looking for information on this kind of thing, because there are a lot of unscrupulous groups out there. People who are, people who take being anti-medication to a whole new level, a whole other level, a dangerous level, and they're all over. And so you have to be very careful again. That's why I have kept my sources on this. I'm using two primary sources. The Harvard Health Publishing arm of Harvard Medical School, and I am using the APA, the American Psychological Association. Now, a lot of these concerns that people have with over-medication and things like that has to do with giving children, like, ADD meds. But I want to stay with the opioids for a second, because this is something that was written in Harvard Health Publishing that was amazing and that more people should be aware of. And that is, there was a study performed that showed that why exactly people don't necessarily trust doctors. And there's all these interesting things that have to do with it, but they have apparently been prescribing, or always have been prescribing, people who have had opiate overdoses opioids to use for pain management. It's because they just don't have the information. There's no unifying source that lets everybody know, no, this person had an opioid overdose. They've had three. Don't give them opioids. Find something else, right? There's nothing for that. So doctors giving people who have had opioid overdoses opioids for pain management, they do that, but it's kind of an innocent mistake, I think. But this, I thought, was very interesting. While the quote from the story, while these measures would certainly help, the reality is that doctors have relatively little training in safely managing chronic pain and treating addiction. Whether in medical school or in residency training, very little curricular time is devoted to helping doctors safely prescribe pain medications, recognize patients at high risk for overdose, intervene when patients need to be taken off opioids, and adequately treat opioid addiction. Now, the thing that's very interesting in here is that there's very little, quote, from the story, quote, very little curricular time is devoted to helping doctors safely prescribe pain medications, end quote. These doctors aren't fucking trained! They're not trained in how to prescribe pain meds. They're just not. And so when you have an organization, when you have a pharmaceutical company, when you have a pharmaceutical company that says, just come to our seminar, come to our pain management seminar. And then at the seminar, the whole seminar is a fucking sales pitch for OxyContin. Well, that's a huge chunk of your pain management training as a doctor, I suppose. Maybe not a huge chunk, but it certainly factors in because you haven't been trained elsewhere, necessarily. Maxo, it's on the individual to say something. His safety isn't worth my privacy, which is where that ends up. But no, I agree. I don't want to be misunderstood. Absolutely, you're correct, Maxo. When talking about sort of a database for like, this dude has overdosed, so don't give him any opioids. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is up to the individual to say something. I agree with you. I agree with you to the point that when it was offered to me when I went to the doctor once, I think I went for a tetanus shot. I think I'd got to step on a nail or some shit. They had said, do you want to sign up for the registry so that all your vaccinations are kept in this like registry? I was just like, no, I don't. Thank you very much. So no, I absolutely agree with you. I absolutely agree with you on that, but it is a problem, right? Like it is a problem. And honestly, to Maxo's point, it didn't just say that they don't know how to prescribe pain medications. It's just they don't know how to recognize patients at high risk for overdose. It says in the story, they're not trained to even spot the signs of what somebody who's an opioid addict looks like, right? Or what to look for when somebody's in and you're going to prescribe them OxyContin or whatever, right? So it doesn't have to be solved with a database, right? That's not what I'm saying. I'm not pushing for that. I don't push for databases or lists. But these doctors aren't trained to do shit with regard to prescribing pain meds. And I could think it's only got to be worse for a dentist, right? I mean, for a DDS as opposed to an MD? I mean, it's got to be worse. Now, moving on to this situation. This is from the American Psychological Association. I recommend everybody read this fucking article. This is amazing, and I'm probably going to link to it. But they're AMA approved. Exactly. This is one of the things that's very interesting to me. From the American Psychological Association, this was written in June 2012. But this is an article that talks exactly about what we're talking about. Inappropriate prescribing. Research shows that all too often Americans are taking medications that may not work or may be inappropriate for their mental health problems. This is getting away from kind of the opioid side of things and going a little bit more toward the psychological meds, right? Which is a problem that we've seen. And I'm gonna mention something that's gonna be kind of bad here in a minute, but I'll just read a little bit of this first. I'm going to skip kind of the introduction part of it, and I'm just going to skip down to the section, Prozac opened the floodgates. When Prozac was approved by the Food and Drug Administration, FDA, approved by the FDA, in 1987, it offered fewer side effects than other common antidepressants, leading to a burgeoning class of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor antidepressants, SSRIs. Since the launch of Prozac, antidepressant use has quadrupled in the United States, and more than 1 in 10 Americans now take antidepressants, according to the CDC. 1 in 10. Antidepressants are the second most commonly prescribed drug in the United States, just after cholesterol-lowering drugs. Oh, fuck me, sideways. Most antidepressants are prescribed by primary care physicians who may have limited training in treating mental health disorders. In the United States, almost 4 out of 5 prescriptions for psychotropic drugs are written by physicians who aren't psychiatrists. That's true. Actually, mine is, I think. And fewer of their patients receive psychotherapy than in the past. That's the big problem. In 1996, 1/3 of patients taking antidepressants also received therapy. By 2005, only 1/5 of patients did. According to a study, more than 50,000 medical surveys that was co-authored by Mark Olson, MD, professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University. Lower clinician reimbursement rates for the psychotherapy and higher out-of-pocket cost to patients most likely contributed to the declining use of therapy, the study found. Quote, antidepressants are overprescribed and underprescribed in the United States, Olson says. Many adults with major depressive disorders go for long periods of time without receiving treatment. At the same time, many people with mild depression are prescribed antidepressants even though they aren't likely to benefit from the drugs, he added. Okay, so this is a problem that persists. And this is a problem that persists, I think, and I have some standing here, because this is depression and anxiety is what I take an SSRI for. It's a very low dose SSRI, 15 milligrams. I've talked to some people who have had similar problems and who have been prescribed similar things. 15 milligrams of a low dose SSRI is child's play, right, to what some of these people are prescribed. I've got friends who prescribe things that are just out fucking outrageous. But there's a lot of problems here. The first and primary problem, I think, is that, problem that is an effect of a different cause, right? Because the causes are different. But you've got people who are depressed, right? And being a depressed person means that you have very low motivation to actually get off your ass and do anything. I have existed in that state at various points in my life. So it's very difficult to actually go to therapy. It's very difficult to actually go to the doctor. It's also much easier as a doctor to say, here, just take this fucking pill, than it is to say, you know, you might need some therapy. Because frankly, therapy is stigmatized still. People still think you go to a therapist, then you must automatically be fucking crazy, right? I mean, that's kind of a common conception. And it's changing, but it's changing slowly. So rather than a doctor basically accuse somebody of being insane in their mind, right? Because that's how it would sound. It's just easier just to prescribe them an antidepressant. But these are the kinds of issues that bubble up, right? When you're dealing with something like depression, you're dealing with a psychiatric problem. Scrolling down more, the drug industry. Health insurance reimbursements are higher and easier to obtain for drug treatment than therapy, which has contributed to the increase... My cat's being angry. Contributed to the increase in psychotropic drug sales and a shifting of psychiatry towards psychopharmacology, says Daniel Carr. I read pharmacology like it wasn't a fucking problem, and I can't do this dude's freaking seven-letter last name. Daniel Carlott, MD, associate clinical professor of psychiatry at Tufts University and author of the 2010 book Unhinged, The Trouble with Psychiatry. There's a huge financial incentive, quote, there's a huge financial incentive for psychiatrists to prescribe instead of doing psychotherapy, he says. You can make 2, 3, 4 times as much money being a prescriber than a therapist. The vicious cycle here is that as psychiatrists limit their practices primarily to prescribing, they lose their therapy skills by attrition and do even less therapy. The pharmaceutical industry has been very successful in marketing psychotropic drugs to physicians and to the public. From 1996 to 2005, the drug industry tripled its spending on marketing, including a 5-fold increase in direct-to-consumer advertising. That's the advertising on the fucking television. And now, with that in mind, I wonder why exactly the news never mentions the fact that these fucking school shooters are taking SSRIs all the fucking time. I wonder why the news wouldn't mention that. Is because all their fucking money comes from these fucking pharmaceutical companies. It's their primary advertiser. The primary advertiser for cable news and network news is pharmaceutical companies. So no, they're not gonna say when the school shooter was taking an SSRI and suddenly stopped and 3 days later he shot up his fucking school. Nobody's gonna fucking talk about that. Because that's where the danger is, by the way. These types of pills, typically, if you're taking them consistently, again, you're fucking with brain chemistry, so things go wrong all the time. But typically, if you're taking it, and you're taking it right, and you're taking it daily, it's fine. It's when you suddenly stop that there's a problem, right? But nobody wants to fucking talk about that either. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that these kids are on these fucking drugs, and they go shoot up a fucking school. They can't talk about it, because their primary fucking advertisers are the ones putting the fucking drugs in. Ooh, I got angry for a second. I need to calm down. Several studies have found that prescription drug ads don't adequately explain side effects and can adversely affect decisions by patients and doctors. In one study, American patients were more than twice as likely to request advertised drugs than patients in Canada, where most direct-to-consumer advertising is prohibited. Patients who requested advertised drugs were nearly 17 times more likely to receive one or more new prescriptions than patients who did not request any drugs. The Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America say that the ads help educate patients about treatment options. The American Psychiatric Association's communications office declined to comment about issues related to inappropriate prescribing or potential ethical problems for psychiatrists who are paid by pharmaceutical companies to promote certain drugs through speaking or consulting fees. Aggressive marketing has also fueled the off-label prescription of antipsychotic drugs for a growing list of mental health disorders, including dementia, anxiety, depression, and insomnia. While physicians can prescribe drugs off-label for various conditions, pharmaceutical companies are prohibited by the FDA from promoting drugs for off-label uses. Over the past 5 years, Eli Lilly, is that how you pronounce that company's name? Pfizer and several other drug companies have agreed to pay settlements totaling billions of dollars for prohibited off-label marketing of their drugs, including antidepressants and antipsychotics. It's a fucking marketing problem. It's all in the fucking marketing. That's all this is. It's also a social problem, but the social problem could be fixed if you fix the fucking marketing problem. Because that's one of the primary issues, is that everybody just wants to solve a problem with a pill, right? You get more money for prescribing a pill, so those two desires match up totally. You got a doctor who gets more money for prescribing a pill, and somebody who wants to fix their problem with a pill, boom, there you go. Right? Not a big problem there. No conflicts there. The pharmaceutical companies want more people to request their drugs, so they go and they pay the networks. They pay the networks so that they can have their ads up on that network's, my cat's on top of my desk. But they go and they pay the networks, and the networks run their ads. But then here's the problem. Now, the networks are beholden to that company. That's why alternative internet radio is ad-free. because the networks become beholden to the company because that's their source of income now. They don't make money if they don't have these pharmaceutical companies. It's a vicious cycle. Now, last section, and then I'm gonna close off the show. The ADHD debate. The public debate about the potential over-medication of children with ADHD drugs has been more vocal than concerns about antipsychotics or antidepressants. That's shifting, by the way. Now the concern is more on opioids than it is on ADHD medication in kids. In part because medicating children is an emotional issue. About 4 million children, or 8% of all youths in the United States, have been diagnosed with ADHD. That sounds like a massive misdiagnosis problem to me, but whatever. It would be weird for 8% of your kids, 8% of all children, right, to have the same disorder, ADHD specifically. If you factor in ADD, the number jumps as well. It's kind of like autism, where like a lot of things are called autism. So like 1 in 4 kids has autism, but really autism's a whole spectrum of things. So it's like you don't have autism. You have this one particular behavioral issue that is autism or is a type of autism, right? Being a libertarian is on that spectrum, or it should be. I'm sorry, that's a joke. It's because we're all autistic, all of us. All those anarcho-capitalists, libertarians, every single one of us. The subjective nature of ADHD symptoms, along with varying reports about children's behavior from parents and teachers, has made it difficult for researchers to untangle the reasons for the increase in diagnosis of ADHD. Part of it's because you've made it the fucking teacher's job, and teachers aren't trained for that shit. So anytime they have a student with a behavioral issue, they want to say they have ADHD, they go to the fucking, principal of the school, or the administration of their school, and they say, hey, I think this kid has ADHD, and he's not diagnosed. And so the administration says, oh, you think so? Well, let's get somebody in there to check it out. And of course the kid gets fucking diagnosed, because they always do, because they're fucking children. Right? So part of it's because it's the teacher's job. The teachers are told it's your job. Just like it's a teacher's job to look for abuse. Right? All these things have been made a teacher's job. Well, a teacher's job is to fucking teach. A teacher doesn't have the training to determine whether or not a kid has ADHD or ADD. Sorry. I've trained to be a teacher. We don't have that training. The American Academy of Pediatrics expanded its guidelines for the diagnosis and treatment of ADHD last year to cover preschoolers and adolescents, since the previous guidelines issued a decade ago were limited to children aged 6 to 12 because of the then available research. The report recommends that preschoolers with ADHD receive behavioral interventions first, such as parent training and behavior management techniques. If those interventions fail, then methylphenidate, I believe it's Ritalin, may be considered only for moderate to severe symptoms. But just as it should be, right? I mean, I'm not going to say that ADHD doesn't exist. I think a lot fewer people have it than you think they do. Because there's a lot about personality, especially when you're dealing with psychiatry. There's a lot about personality that's diagnosable. Look at ODD. I just wanted to pull this up real quick, because this is something not a lot of people know. I posted this on Twitter, and a lot of people acted totally surprised by it. I'm going to pull up ODD. ODD. I need to put in wiki. There's too much. Oh, it's because it's actually the word odd. ODD is oppositional defiant disorder, defined by the DSM-5 as the DSM-5. It's a real thing. The DSM-5 is a, I know, Max, so fuck ODD, it's stupid. It's in the DSM-5, which is the manual that is used by psychiatrists and psychologists to determine if you have a disorder. Defined by the DSM-5 as a pattern of angry / irritable mood, argumentative / defiant behavior, or vindictiveness. Unlike children with conduct disorder, CD, children with oppositional conduct disorder is a fucking, oh, God. See, there's so much of just personality that we've decided is a disorder. That's the fucking problem. Ugh. Children with oppositional defiant disorder are not aggressive towards people or animals. They do not destroy property, and they do not show a pattern of theft or deceit. So wait a minute. They're nonviolent. People with ODD are defined as being nonviolent. So they just don't like authority. Ugh, fuck. I'll get into it. Signs and symptoms. The fourth revision of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the DSM-4TR, now replaced by the DSM-5, stated that the child must exhibit 4 out of 8 signs and symptoms to meet the diagnostic threshold for oppositional defiant disorder. You're listening to this show. You're probably a fucking anarchist, or at the very least a libertarian. See how many of these you fit. The symptoms include 1. Often loses temper. 2. Is often touchy or easily annoyed. 3. Is often angry and resentful. 4. Often argues with authority figures or for children and adolescents with adults. 5, often actively defies or refuses to comply with requests from authority figures or with rules. 6, often deliberately annoys others. 7, often blames others for his or her mistakes or misbehavior. Okay, so, Maxo, codified and almost illegal. Give it a few years. Exactly. Well, this is the issue, Maxo, is that ODD is, Maxo says all. Right. I'm not all of these. I don't often lose my temper. I do periodically, but not often. Often touchy or easily annoyed. That's me. Often angry and resentful. Toward specific things, toward government specifically, yes. 4, often argues with authority figures, or for children and adolescents with adults. Right. This, by the way, if you're a kid and you don't think that every adult is an authority, you automatically got one of these. Oh my God. 5, often actively defies or refuses to comply with requests from authority figures or with rules. That's what landed me in jail. 6, often deliberately annoys others. Shitposting. 7, often blames others for his or her mistakes or misbehavior. I try not to do that, but of course I do sometimes. 8, has been spiteful or vindictive at least twice within the past 6 months. Spiteful and vindictive. I'm doing a whole fucking podcast about how much I hate our socio-political situation. Does that make me spiteful or vindictive? It might. Oh, good God almighty. And here's the thing. Maxo's saying almost illegal. Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. If you suddenly decide that people who have a mental disorder shouldn't be allowed to buy a gun, I already take 15 milligrams of an SSRI. I guarantee your ass I'm on that fucking list. And outside of that, I meet the criteria for ODD. So I'll finish this just real quick and then I've got to be done because I'm actually getting myself riled up. I'm not going to be able to go to sleep. These behaviors are mostly directed towards an authority figure, such as a teacher or parent, although these behaviors can be typical among siblings that must be observed in individuals other than siblings. Waco. Yeah, exactly, Waco. Children with ODD can be verbally aggressive. However, they do not display physical aggressiveness, a behavior observed in conduct disorder. Furthermore, they must be perpetuated for longer than 6 months and must be considered beyond a normal child's age, gender, and culture to fit the diagnosis. For children under 5 years of age, they occur on most days over a period of 6 months. For children over 5 years of age, they occur at least twice a week or for at least 6 months. It is possible to observe these symptoms in only one setting, most commonly home. Thus, severity would be mild. If it is observed in 2 settings, then it would be characterized as moderate. And if the symptoms are observed in 3 or more settings, then it would be considered severe. These patterns of behavior result in impairment at school and other social venues. Waco. Well, you actually made a point. Maxo in the chat. He put Waco, and I was like, yeah, Waco. And he said, meant wackos. And I was like, yeah, well, you also made a point with Waco. Works both ways. Yeah, of course, Max makes the point, it sounds scientific. Of course it sounds scientific. They have to make this stuff sound scientific. But it's not scientific at all. It's just we don't like this kind of behavior. This kind of behavior is considered to be socially unacceptable. And thus, you have a disorder if you subscribe to it. Now, being violent, conduct disorder, stuff like that, fucking with other people's shit or their bodily person, that's a fucking problem. But not liking authority? Sorry. Fuck you. Maybe that's my ODD talking, but fuck you. Right? Again, you're listening to this podcast. You probably see how many of those you fucking fit into. I do a weekly podcast about how shitty government is, about how shitty our socio-political situation is. What is that? Weekly? That means I probably do it every 6 months. I do it. So 4 times. I can't do quick math. Doesn't matter. A lot. So that's the thing. It's going to be, it's a problem. Especially if they start making laws based on this kind of shit. Again, like you're not allowed to own a gun if you have a specific disorder. Or if you have a set of disorders. Or really, frankly, because the people haven't been told about this, but everybody certainly knows it, they might make it to where you can own a gun if you take an SSRI. Because SSRIs are a commonality. They're not always a factor, but they are something of a commonality among mass shooters. Not just SSRIs, but psychotropic medications overall. SSRIs are a very specific kind of psychotropic medication. It actually bothers me when people call all psychotropic drugs SSRIs, because they're not. SSRIs have a very specific thing that they do. Not all psychotropic drugs share that. But psychotropic drugs are certainly a commonality among mass shooters. To a point of statistical significance, meaning that if they were going to say that if you wanted to say people who are not allowed to have guns if they're, you know, if they have certain personality or mental disorders, then there you go. That's already a statistically significant factor in mass shooting, is taking those drugs. So, I don't know. I don't like looking down the road, because often it's very dark. So, we'll see how that goes. We'll see how all this shakes out. I do want to roll back to something real quick. Don't fuck with people who are in therapy. Don't congratulate them for being in therapy. Because being in therapy, number one, socially, it's a hard decision to make. It's a hard decision to make to go decide to sit for an hour in a room with somebody and frankly, bare your soul. It's not easy to do. And there's a social stigma attached to it. So when people say they're in therapy, No, it's good. It's a good thing. Good therapy is a good thing. Now, there is such a thing as bad therapy. Being in therapy for years at a time, you know, you don't have a goal, obviously. You're there to solve a problem, aren't you? If you're not solving the problem after a couple of years, maybe find a different fucking therapist. Right? That, to me, just looks like a doctor pumping somebody for money. But regardless, therapy is a good thing. And if somebody says they're in therapy, don't shit in their mouth over it. And if you feel like you need it, go. If you feel like you need it, you probably need it. And if you get a good therapist, they might tell you you don't need it. And that's fine, too. Take their advice. I had a therapist when I was younger. I had a therapist who basically said, stop coming. I've told you everything that you need to know. You've been implementing the tools that I've given you, so, and you're not crazy, so stop coming. You don't need to be seeing me every week, every other week. Okay. All right, so if you want therapy, if you feel like you might need therapy, you feel like you need to work some shit out, go to a therapist, man. Do it. I'm 100% behind you, and I will never make fun of you for going to a therapist. Me, personally, I will never make fun of you for going to a therapist. And then once you realize how good and healthy it is, then we can make fun of each other for going to a therapist. Because, you know, if you can't rib each other, you're not really friends. But, that's all I have to say for this show. That's all I have to say. So, with that, I want to thank everybody, and I want to let you all know that I'm very happy that you're listening, and I want to thank Maxo very much for hanging out in chat and talking to me while I do the show. Y'all have a wonderful, wonderful week. Remember, everybody, you can find me on Twitter at DinoFiles, no spaces, no dashes. You can find the network at AltNet Radio. You can find this show and other shows all get posted to Alternative Internet Radio, AIRAD.io. You can find the posts, the blog posts that correspond to this show at The Rogue File, roguefile.com. You can also donate to the show from there or from AIR. You can donate. You have many options for that. A lot of, there's Patreon. There's also different versions of crypto you can donate. You can also get merch if you want something for your money. We have a merch store there as well. I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to thank those of you who download to listen, those of you who stream live, and I want to thank those of you who rate and review us on iTunes or whatever platform. I want to thank those of you who hang out and chat and keep me on my toes during the show. You are all wonderful people, and you should all have a wonderful week.
This show is part of the Alternative Internet Radio Podcast Network. For more great shows like this, visit AIR at AIRAD.io.